And you can open your copy of the Bible, the Scriptures, to Psalm 16. I'm turning in mine to Acts chapter 2. But you can start with Psalm 16. On this resurrection date, 2016, I wanted to talk about resurrection joy forever. True joy. It's a very basic topic, but something very near and dear to each one of us. Talking about joy. Joy is the delight we experience when desire is fulfilled. If we were try to put a definition on joy, it's the delight we experience when desire is fulfilled. Now, that can be true joy to the extent that what we desire is what is truly fulfilling for us, that is truly good for us, truly fulfills what we were meant for. In that case, it's true joy. If the desire is placed somewhere else, then we can even experience a false joy. But Psalm 16, the passage we're looking at here in the Psalms, shows us where true joy is to be found. And we discover in this text that Jesus Christ's resurrection from the dead has everything to do with our joy. Perhaps, growing up in this world, we don't immediately think that. But I hope we'll see that today, that Jesus Christ's resurrection has everything to do with our joy. In fact, it gives us eternal joy in God. So, to set this up, to open up our thoughts on this passage, I want to draw your attention to one of the most powerful sermons in the history of the world. A sermon that launched the church on its worldwide mission to exalt Jesus Christ as the risen Lord, which was the sermon the Apostle Peter preached in Acts chapter 2, we call the Day of Pentecost. In this sermon, Peter used our text today as one of his texts. And so I always think it's helpful to look at what the apostles preached when they talked about the Scriptures and thought about the Scriptures. Listen carefully as I read to you what Peter said. "Men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death, because it was not possible for him to be held by it. For, here's why it was not possible for Jesus to be held by death. For David says concerning him, 'I saw the Lord always before me, for he is at my right hand that I may not be shaken. Therefore my heart was glad and my tongue rejoiced. My flesh also will dwell in hope. For you will not abandon my soul to Hades or let your Holy One see corruption. You have made known to me the paths of life. You will make me full of gladness with your presence.'" Quoting Psalm 16. Peter went on, "Brothers, I may say to you with confidence about the patriarch David that he both died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day. Being therefore a prophet, and knowing that God had sworn with an oath to him that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, he foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ, that he was not abandoned to Hades, nor did his flesh see corruption. This Jesus God raised up, and of that we are all witnesses, being therefore exalted at the right hand of God, and having received from the Father the promise of the Holy Spirit, he has poured out this which you yourselves are seeing and hearing. For David did not ascend into the heavens, but he himself says, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool.'" Quoting Psalm 110, which we read today. "Let all the house of Israel therefore know for certain that God has made him both Lord and Christ," Messiah, anointed one, "this Jesus whom you crucified. This Jesus God raised up. It was not possible for him to be held by death because of what David prophesied in Psalm 16. And so here we have an inspired commentary on Psalm 16 and what this text is designed to show us today. And so I want to walk through Psalm 16 with us today twice. I want to walk through it, first of all, to see how this text shows us Jesus' resurrection joy. And then I want to turn around and walk back through it to show that in the light of that, how it shows us our resurrection joy, your resurrection joy as it's found in Jesus Christ. But first of all, first and foremost, I believe this psalm really is speaking of Jesus Christ our Lord. And in a very real sense, it's prophesying of Him. It's looking forward to Him. So that what it says gives us insight into Jesus' very experience of going through His crucifixion and His resurrection. Just like last Lord's Day, we looked at Psalm 22, which helped us understand what Jesus went through in His death on our behalf. Now we'll look at Psalm 16, which helps us to understand what Jesus went through in His resurrection hope for us. Psalm 16, we see Jesus' resurrection joy. First of all, we see Jesus praying for preservation in His time of peril. Verse 1, "Preserve me, O God, for in You I take refuge." We shouldn't miss the fact that though this psalm goes on immediately to talk about other things, it starts in a prayer. It starts from where Jesus is at, facing the difficulty, and looking to the Lord to preserve him, to find His refuge, to find His hope and His trust right there in the Lord, His Father, and God. "Preserve me, O God, for in You I take refuge." And verses 2 through 4 then, well, I should say, verses 2 and following show this Jesus placing His entire confidence in the Lord. And verses 2 through 4 confess that confidence. Jesus gives confession to His confidence in the Lord. "I say to the Lord, You are my Lord, my Master. I have no good apart from You. As for the saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips." Pay attention to what's being said here. Jesus' complete hope was in the Lord, entire confidence in Him. He says, "You are my Lord. I have no good apart from You." Apart from the Lord, nothing is good. There is no such thing as a good thing. Do you realize the force of what he's saying there? There is no such thing as a good thing apart from the Lord. That's where his confidence and his hope was. It's actually very similar to another psalm, Psalm 73, verse 25, which puts it this way, "Whom have I in heaven but You? And there is nothing on earth that I desire besides You." And we have to see here right away, folks, this is crucial to Jesus' whole perspective of life on this earth. Anything that could be counted as a good thing was not good apart from the Lord. Just let's play the ramifications of that out a little bit in our minds. What about health? Most of you, I think, would think health is a good thing, a desirable thing, something we would want as a good in our lives. Health, that would be good. But Jesus is saying, apart from the Lord, that's not a good thing. How about success in business? We would want to be at least reasonably, moderately successful in what we attempt to do, right? We want to be able to enjoy our work and find some kind of satisfaction and at least pay the bills, right? That would be a good thing. We certainly wouldn't want the opposite of that. But he's saying, apart from You, Lord, success in business is not good. Retirement accounts. It's a good thing. Good friendships. How many of us enjoy good friendships? And we consider that a delightful thing in our lives. But Jesus is actually saying, apart from You, this is not good. Marriage, children. How much delight do we take in the children that God blesses us with, how much joy. Apart from You, there is no good thing. Lots of people who look up to You and respect You, perhaps, might think of as a good thing. We would want to be respected, want to be appreciated. Or maybe we could even think a little bit more, not just in terms of ourselves, but other people. Helping others, that's a good thing in life, right? I'd like to give myself to help other people. Apart from You, there is that helping others apart from the Lord is not a good. How about making the world a better place? I'd like my life to count because I made the world a better place. Apart from You, There is no good. I have no good apart from you. You see, apart from the Lord, all of these things, whatever it might be in your life that you look to as a good thing, is not an enduring good thing. You see, what is good for you ultimately is what fulfills the purpose for which you were made, the purpose for which you exist. And none of those things I've just listed can actually fulfill the purpose for which you were made. They might play a role in it, they might play a part in it, but they cannot fulfill what you were made for. All lesser goods cut off from an ultimate good become worthless. And we can see Jesus exemplifying this in his life. If we just listen to Jesus praying, for example, in John chapter 17, as just before his crucifixion, he offers what we call his high priestly prayer to the Father. You see clearly in that prayer what Jesus saw as his final good, what really mattered ultimately. It was the Father glorifying the Son so the Son can glorify the Father. It was that mutual indwelling and union with the Father. It was the love of the Father and the Son shared with all who belong to the Son. These are the kinds of things that Jesus is praying for. This is the good that he is after in life, even more than life itself. And so we see in Psalm 16 this confidence that Jesus has, entire confidence, complete hope in the Lord. And this confidence then shows in the Lord, shows itself in Jesus' complete hope as well as in his complete loyalty to the Lord in verses 3 and 4. He delights, first of all, in those who are holy ones, verse 3, the saints in the land, those who are loyal to the Lord, those who are set apart to the Lord. Those were the people that are Jesus' delight. Now, why is it bringing it up here? He's going to contrast that with those who go after other gods. There's those who are set apart to the Lord, and there are those who go after other gods. Which group is he going to align himself with? I delight in those who delight in you. I do not go with, don't have anything to do with those who go apart from you, he is saying. He delights in the holy ones. And again, in the New Testament, just to stay with John chapter 17, we see Jesus doing this. He says in John chapter 17, verse 9, I am praying for them. I am praying, not praying for the world, but for those whom you have given me, for they are yours. They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify, set them apart in the truth. Your word is truth. Did you see what Jesus did pray there? I want you, Father. I'm praying for, I'm identified with, I'm invested in those who are set apart to you. Not the world. The world being those who, that system in rebellion against God, rejecting the true God, going after false gods. Jesus personally exemplified the new commandment to love one another. And that's because the Father loves him and he loves the Father. And so he delights in all the people who love the Lord. He says this in John chapter 14, verse 21. Whoever has my commandments and keeps them, he it is who loves me. And he who loves me will be loved by my Father, and I will love him and manifest myself to him. You see, this is the same kind of thing that the psalmist is saying in Psalm 16:3. As for the saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. I invest myself in them. I identify myself with them. The flip side of that complete loyalty to the Lord, then, is complete and total refusal to acknowledge any other god. The sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out, or take their names on my lips, even, he says, reflecting Exodus 23's command, not to even take upon yourself the names of the false gods. He says, absolutely not. Now, in Jesus' case, his loyalty was tested right out of the gate in his public ministry. At the beginning of his earthly ministry, when Satan himself tried to get him to turn from his absolute loyalty to the Lord, his absolute trust and dependence and confidence in the Lord, to first himself and then even ultimately to Satan. But of course, unlike the first Adam, who did not resist Satan's attack, the last Adam, Jesus, did. He succeeded where the first Adam failed. He stayed true. He said, "Be gone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Matthew 4:10. By the way, this also played out in his earthly ministry. in his opposition to those who were of the father, their father, the devil. They would not receive him. Jesus was completely loyal to his Father because he trusted him. And the psalm goes on here to show us there was good reason for this confidence. There was good reason for this absolute confidence that's expressed in verses 2 through 4. Because Psalm 16 goes on to express the reasons for this great trust in the Lord. As first of all, verse 5, a beautiful inheritance from the Lord. And secondly, in verse 6, good counsel from the Lord. Why? What were the causes of this great confidence? Well, first of all, verse 5, his beautiful inheritance. The Lord is my chosen portion, or my allotted portion, and my cup. You hold my lot. The lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. Now, make sure you're getting the picture here. You might be puzzled a little bit when you first read that and say, what is he really talking about? He's really using, well, what we've read about in our scripture readings. Remember reading, we've been reading through Joshua, and the scripture keeps talking about all the boundaries of the inheritances of the tribes of Israel. And it lays out the names of towns and rivers and, you know, tells us what their geographical boundaries were. And a lot of times, we 21st century Americans hear all this strange geography that we've never heard of those towns, and they don't even exist anymore. And we're thinking, you know, why is that really so important to be in the Bible? I don't certainly feel like I get a blessing out of it or something. We have to understand the whole point of God giving the land to Israel. This was the place where they would dwell with him, in communion with him. And it wasn't just ethereal place, it was actual place. Like, outworking of God's plan on the real earth place. And you live here, and you live in communion with me, and through this, as you serve me, I bless you and provide prosperity and permanence and stability and security for you. And I walk with you, and you walk with me, and I'm your God, and you're my people. And this was where the land in Israel always pointed beyond itself to that relationship with God. And so the psalmist, I think, understanding exactly the meaning of the land, points to his relationship with God and says, you know what? That's actually ultimately what is being fulfilled here. In fact, God even gave the Israelites a clue into this pointing meaning of the land and its ultimate fulfillment in himself by giving one tribe that didn't have an inheritance in the land, because their inheritance was the Lord, the Levites. Their inheritance was him. And as priests, they were consecrated to him. And God was through that then ultimately pointing all of his people to himself. And so that's why David says here, as he's writing Psalm 16, the Lord is my portion, my allotted portion, and my cup, the bounty that comes from that portion. You hold my lot, the lot that's allotted to me in the land. The lines, the boundary lines, have fallen for me in pleasant places. Indeed, I have a beautiful inheritance. This is wonderful what God has given to me, which is a gift from himself. Now, looking to Jesus, taking these words as his own. Jesus' inheritance is ultimately the whole world, but even especially the saints. You know, Paul prayed that the Spirit would enlighten our hearts to see the riches of Christ's glorious inheritance in the saints, Ephesians 1:18. And so Jesus came, he lived, he died, he rose again, he reigns right now to claim that inheritance, to purify for himself a beautiful bride. Jesus could say that his inheritance was beautiful. This is wonderful what God in his bounty has provided for me. That's why I trust him. He has blessed me abundantly. Going on in Psalm 16, then, the Lord also had his Lord's good counsel, which results in protection and permanence. This is the true refuge. By the way, don't forget, this is the true refuge that he sought in the Lord. Verse 1, in the Lord I take refuge. He's taken refuge in the Lord, and what has the Lord given him? Good counsel. I bless the Lord, verse 7, who gives me counsel. In the night also my heart instructs me. Or again, literally, even my kidneys as a seat of emotions instruct me. I have set the Lord always before me, because he is at my right hand. I shall not be shaken. He had the Lord's good counsel. And Jesus said this when he was on earth, truly, truly, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all that he himself is doing. John chapter 5. And even to Jesus' last hours, he was seeking the Father's will when he prayed, Father, if you are willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. This was Jesus' experience. The psalm is truly being fulfilled in him. And because of that, therefore, verse 9 says, Jesus had, what I'm going to call here, resurrection joy forever. Verses 9 through 11. Therefore, my heart is glad, and my whole being, or literally my glory, rejoices. My flesh also dwells secure, for you will not abandon my soul to Sheol, or let your Holy One see corruption. You make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Jesus had resurrection joy forever. He had confidence of God's presence even through the experience of death, verses 9 and 10. Even through the experience of death, he had confidence of God's presence. And then he had confidence of life with God after death in verse 11. And here's where the resurrection part of it comes in. He had gladness through death and joy in the presence of God. You see, as he went through death, there was gladness. There was even security. Even to his flesh, notice this. My flesh dwells secure. Why does he say my flesh? What is our flesh? Well, that's what decays. That's what, I mean, we are dust, and to dust we return. Right? That's what happens to us in death. We decay. But here he says, my flesh is going to dwell secure. Every aspect of my being, even down to that part of me that would decay and turn to dust, has security here through the experience of death. This is an amazing thing. Really, here is an answer to, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because he says, you will not abandon, same term as forsaken in Psalm 22, you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. Or let your Holy One see corruption. You will not do that. My God, why have you abandoned or forsaken me? Ultimately, I know you will not abandon me. You will take all of who I am and restore, even to the point of not letting your Holy One see corruption. And did you notice when he read Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost? That his whole argument turned on that point. You're not going to let your Holy One decay. The body's going to go, is going to die, be buried, but that's not going to be the end of the story. It's not going to do then what all of our bodies do. Why? Because there's going to be something else coming. Verse 11, you make known to me the path of life. You're going to show me the way of life. And the path of life, by the way, is a wisdom term. It's the path that leads to life that wise people walk. You'll find it often in the book of Proverbs. The path of life. This is the path that wise people take because it leads to life. That's where it really ends up, as opposed to the path that foolish people take, which ends up in death. And so here we see the good counsel of the Lord that we talked about back in verse 7 coming to fruition. I'm following that path of the counsel of the Lord. I'm following the right way. Here's the blessing of a pleasant inheritance coming to its eternal completion in God. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. He had a pleasant inheritance, a beautiful inheritance, but that was all really pointing him toward and coming to completion in the right hand of God, where he would find pleasures forevermore. Unending pleasures. You see, all the promise and the meaning and purpose of life is accomplished in resurrection life. The meaning and purpose of life is accomplished, brought to fruition, brought to its full meaning and purpose in resurrection life. That's the hope being expressed here. And by the way, don't miss this exchange too. He says in verse 8, I set the Lord at my right hand, his whole confidence, hope, trust being in him, following him, his ways, walking according to what the Lord taught him. And therefore the Lord sets his faithful one at his right hand. That's exactly what Peter preached, Acts chapter 2. Being therefore exalted at the right hand of God. Jesus was exalted to the place of power and authority with God the Father. Jesus has full joy forever in the presence of God. That's Jesus' resurrection hope. That's exactly what Jesus experienced in his earthly pilgrimage, dying and rising again on our behalf. But now I want to ask, does this psalm then apply to you and me as well? If this was a prophecy of Jesus, then that certainly is wonderful. And it does teach us much, just the very brief overview we've done so far about how this applied to Jesus. And we see this working out in Jesus' life. That's wonderful. But is it given to us merely to say, okay, that's what Jesus was like? Or is it also in some ways designed to be ours? And I think the answer to that is certainly yes. Just as surely as this psalm applied to David as the forebearer of the anointed one, Jesus, so surely it applies to all who are in him, all who are united to Jesus by faith. It applies to us as Christ's seed. I can put it this way, it applies to all who believe in Jesus because through faith, we are united to him in his death and resurrection. Isn't that not what Romans chapter 6 teaches? That we are buried with him and raised again to walk in newness of life. And through that union with Jesus Christ, I believe Psalm 16 applies very much to us. And therefore, we can walk back through the same psalm and see your resurrection joy in Jesus. If you truly are a believer in Jesus, that means one who has looked to him and seen him as the anointed one and seen him as the one who gives his life as a ransom for sinners and turned from your sin and trusting in yourself, finding all that hope and satisfaction and meaning and trying to do that in yourself, trying to rule the world for yourself, and repenting of that and saying, no, Jesus is the only one. He is the only one who can conquer sin and death and Satan. And I'm going to take refuge in him. Taking refuge in the Lord, then think for you, Psalm 16 shows your resurrection joy in Jesus. You, right now, as you're walking through this earth as it is right now, you look to the Lord. Preserve me, O God, for in you I take refuge. Your trust is in him. You look to him to deliver you. And how do you see that working out? What is your confidence that that's going to work out in? Well, verses 2 through 8 show that confidence. You confess your confidence, pardon me, in verse 2. I say to the Lord, you are my Lord. I have no good apart from you, a complete hope in the Lord. I think we saw this very poignantly last week. We looked death full in the face. What does this really mean for us? And the fact is, death puts into perspective all earthly goods, and only those who have a hope in God have eternal hope. Whose good is in God have an eternal hope. There is no good apart from the Lord. Where is your hope today? If, for instance, a Job-like experience were to happen to you, and all your earthly powers, possessions, everything was stripped away from you, where would your hope be then? What if you were like the gentleman that we looked at last week, a very earnest man, a very honest man in many ways, who looked death full in the face and realized it undid all of my aspirations, everything I worked so hard to achieve, and now what is it going to mean? You see, only those whose good is in God have an eternal hope. Where is your hope? This is the confidence that a resurrection joy gives us. It also inspires us to a complete loyalty to the Lord. As for the saints in the land, they are the excellent ones in whom is all my delight. The sorrows of those who run after another god shall multiply. Their drink offerings of blood I will not pour out or take their names on my lips. As we might put it in our language, the proverb, birds of a feather flock together. Right? You're going to identify with those who identify with the Lord, who have their hope there. It's not that you don't show love or kindness or compassion to all men, just as Jesus Christ himself did. But where your identity is, where your family group is, so to speak, your loyalty is to the Lord. And therefore, it's with all those who love the Lord, who are set apart to him, as opposed to those who are idolaters, absolutely refusing to participate in any kind of idolatry, any kind of false worship, any kind of loyalty anywhere else but in Jesus Christ alone. Complete loyalty to the Lord. That's your confidence. And why can you have that confidence? Because the Lord has given you a good inheritance. He is your portion and your cup. The lines have fallen for you in pleasant places. I have a beautiful inheritance. You begin to see, in light of the resurrection of Jesus Christ and your life in him, you begin to see everything in this life in light of its eternal perspective, in light of what it means for eternity. So let's say you do have a retirement account. That's a gift from God, right? It's not where I put my hope. It's not where I put my trust. It's not where I find my identity or my hope for the future. Like, when I get old, I got this, so I'm okay, right? No. It's in the Lord. And as he in his goodness provides for you, this is just a foretaste of what you have to experience in him. This is a beckoning, in a sense. It's God giving you a little bit of taste of how good he is and how gracious he is to provide for you abundantly, even though you are a sinner deserving his wrath. You deserve his judgment, but instead he graciously calls you to himself and provides for you day after day after day, gives you all of your daily bread, meets your needs. You can say, I have a beautiful inheritance. You have instruction from the Lord. Verses 7 and 8. I bless the Lord who gives me counsel. God has not just left you in this world without giving you instruction on the path of life. Where do I go? What do I follow? How do I know your ways? I bless the Lord. I lift him up and exalt him. This means to publicly bless him, to exalt him before others, because he has given us his guidance, because he directs us. And so to put him before us is really, in a true sense, to put his word before us. In fact, Psalm 119, by the way, uses this exact phrase. I have set the Lord, when it says in verse 8, I have set the Lord always before me. The psalmist speaks of setting his word before him. It's his counsel. It's his guidance. It's learning to follow the Lord in life, following his way. That gives us confidence because the Lord has provided the instruction that we need. He's not only provided the physical provision we need, he's provided the instruction we need to be able to follow him to this resurrection joy. And that then results in gladness forever in verses 9 through 11. Your resurrection joy in Jesus Christ, united to him by faith, you can say, therefore my heart is glad, my glory rejoices, my flesh also shall dwell secure. For you will not abandon my soul to Sheol. You can have that confidence in the Lord. As you face death, you can have gladness through it. Instead of death becoming the dissolution of the very center of your being, a coming apart, instead of it being a loss of the source of your life, it becomes a time of confidence. You will not abandon me. I trust in you. I don't have the power to carry myself through death. That's the one thing death makes very plain. I don't have life in myself. I can't keep myself alive. But you can. In fact, what you will do is make known to me the path of life. You will show me the way to your very presence. And you will show me joy in the presence of God forever. The path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. Here's where all those joys that are on this earth come into their own. Remember, we talked about joy being the experience of delight in desire fulfilled. And if that desire is rightly directed, of course, that fulfillment is what is good for us, what actually truly does fulfill our being. And what truly fulfills us as creatures made in the image of God, formed from the dust of the ground, breathed into the nostrils a breath of life, making us living souls, what actually fulfills us? It's nothing less than God Himself. Try it. I would challenge you today to try it out. Anything else you can try, try it. It will not ultimately fulfill your soul. Because apart from the Lord, we have no good. Seek after pleasure. Give yourself to it. See what you can find. Many people have walked that road before you. Hundreds and thousands of them. Some of the wealthiest people in the world who could do whatever their heart desired. Some of the most knowledgeable people in all the history of the world have pursued that path to see if they could get whatever their heart desired and find fulfillment there. And it didn't work. Try some other god, like verse 4 is talking about. Try some other god and see if that will bring fulfillment for you. Ultimate resurrection joy. Has there been any other god, as we talked about this morning in our sunrise service, actually, has there ever been any other god who has entered into death for us and then raised again to bring us with him to his kind of life? Well, there are all kinds of religions that believe in an afterlife. That's not unusual. People from all of recorded history have believed in an afterlife of some kind. Whether it's the Greeks and their Hades, or a kind of an afterlife that is hopefully, as in some Eastern religions, a melding with the great soul of the universe until we lose our personal identity. Or try Allah. Has Allah ever taken on death for you? Can Allah die? Not according to Islam. Can He have you enter into His own life? No, according to Islam, you'll have an afterlife and He'll give you some kind of pleasures, but you must forever be a servant, separate from Him. It's not possible to be anything else according to Islam's own teachings. But here, God makes known the path of life, a way to His presence, to His very right hand, where we enjoy His own life, His own joy. Psalm 36, 8 and 9 put it this way. They, those people God redeems and loves, they feast on the abundance of your house, and you give them drink from the river of your delights, a river of delights, unending supply. For with you is the fountain of life. In your light do we see light. You see, this is joy for all who are united to Jesus Christ by trusting Him completely. This is what puts the meaning into our lives right now. This is your resurrection joy in Jesus Christ and in Him alone. Apart from Him, there is no good. Cut off from Christ, there is no ultimate hope. You might achieve all there is to achieve in this world, but death will end it. Death will end it. But do you have a hope that goes through death to the very presence of God? That's why I said from the beginning, Jesus' resurrection gives us eternal joy in God. We've gathered together today here to celebrate, to rejoice in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. From a worldly perspective, we might think, what really is the big deal? Even the kind of celebration we've had today, from a worldly perspective, we could say, well, we could have more fun doing other things, right? We could have a party. Maybe to me it's more fun to go to the Super Bowl. Maybe to me it's more fun to make $1 million. You know, maybe we could say it's more fun. I could do other things. But why are there these people, these strange people called Christians, who will even get up out of bed early on a day like today and come together to sing songs of joy about a man named Jesus rising from the dead a long time ago. Why is that really true? It's because, folks, we realize, those who are Christians realize, our whole hope, every ounce of joy we ever experience ultimately comes back to this. And if this is not true, then our hope is in vain. But that's just it. It is true. Jesus is risen. And he had that resurrection joy, and now he takes us with him to that full experience of joy, fullness of joy at his right hand. And that then, that joy just trickles down and pulses out into everything. Even it's almost like going backwards in time from eternity till now, touching us now. And we begin to experience eternal joy in our hearts, a settled delight, a delight in the experience of having desire fulfilled. Our souls begin to recognize, this is what I was made for. I wasn't made for anything less than this. And this gives me a satisfaction that nothing else can. Eternal joy. This is unending quantitatively. Qualitatively, it's eternal. It's everything. Jesus' resurrection gives us eternal joy in God. I trust that's your joy today. If it's not, would you come to Jesus as the one who can give you resurrection joy? If it is, how can I say this? Claim that joy. Make it yours. Lay hold of it. Rejoice in Jesus Christ. See who he is and what he's accomplished, as Psalm 16 talks about it, and give your heart wholly to rejoicing in him.